Opinions that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Dr. David Ayoub, and we're going to be talking about what he has learned is analyzing the effect of mercury on on pregnant women, on children, and there is so much information that is coming out of the hazardous effects of the thimerosal that they have insisted on putting into the vaccines, and they've known going back to the 1930s that this had toxic effect on the minds of animals. In fact, it is said that if you go up on PubMed and you put in thimerosal, you'll find literally hundreds and hundreds of articles telling you how toxic thimerosal is. Only one article telling you it's safe, and in that study, everybody died safe. Well, they claim it was safe because everybody died, and yet they've been giving this to our children, and more recently, they've outlawed the use of thimerosal in childhood drugs here, childhood vaccines here in the United States, but we're continuing to give it to children all throughout the world. Now, if it's bad in America, why are we giving it to children throughout the world? And Bill Gates, and now, of course, as you know, Warren Buffett has given some $30 billion of his to the Gates Foundation, and they're going to have vaccination programs for children throughout the world, and they're also involved in population control. Why would you be giving vaccines to protect the lives of children and be stressing population control at the same time? Those two things seem to be at odds with one another, at least you might think. And then, of course, what they've done is here in the United States, even though they've taken the thimerosal supposedly out of childhood vaccines, they've left it in influenza vaccine, which they recommend not only for six-month-old children, but also for pregnant women. So with that as a background, Dr. David Ayoub, thanks very much for being with us, David.
Thanks, Dr. Stan.
Well, why don't you sort of pick up the story? Because you've done so much work on this, and you've gone far beyond what I ever analyzed. Why don't you tell our listeners why you're concerned and what you have actually come up with? And I know you've published one or two articles recently on this subject.
Yes, and boy, I think you've really hit the nail on the head. We have been told that mercury has been taken out of childhood vaccines. But boy, this is just another example of deception. It has come out of some of the childhood vaccines, but the reality is we have increased the amount of mercury given to children now, in part through what we're giving in the flu vaccine in pregnancy. But we have gone up now, it'll be three consecutive years of increases of mercury since we took it out of the childhood vaccines beginning in 1999. To give you a quantitative idea of that, in 99 when the CDC came out and said they were going to take it out, the kids by the age of five were getting 237 micrograms of mercury. That was a huge cumulative dose. They took it out of immunohepatitis. They took it out of Haemophilus B influenza and the DTP vaccine, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis. But they increased the influenza vaccine schedule. They recommended it to children 6 to 23 months of age in 2004. They added the first trimester in addition to pre-existing second and third trimester recommendations for pregnant women. They promoted it. In other words, they encouraged it through the College of OB-GYN. So we were seeing immunization coverage rates increase in that, not only just the recommendation to who we were giving it to. And coming up this year now...
Well, hold that thought right. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. David Ayoub. Well, this is Dr. Stan. David was just saying that actually they have increased the amount of mercury that the child is going to get because by recommending it being given in the first trimester of pregnancy, why, of course, then it's concentrated in the brain of the developing child in the mother's womb. And you pick up the story there.
That's right. So our current calculations, today by the age of five, a child will get 125 micrograms of mercury. And the previous peak was 237. So we're over 50% of the peak. And if you carefully analyze that, we're giving it to people at an earlier age through the flu vaccine in pregnancy. So if you calculate based on an adjusted, a weight-adjusted analysis, it turns out we're giving just about as much mercury on a per kilogram basis today as we ever have. So I would say quite a deception. We are still loading up the mercury. And, of course, these very strong implications that this is responsible for, amongst other health effects, neurodevelopmental disorders, including autism. We certainly don't expect to see autism rates dropping anytime soon, as long as we're still pouring mercury into the developing brain.
And, of course, is there any evidence that mercury is toxic to the developing brain?
Oh, boy. Is there evidence? Well, we certainly know that many forms of mercury are absolutely toxic, and I think the government health officials and physician organizations certainly wouldn't argue that methylmercury is extremely toxic to the developing brain, and we have just volumes of science going back decades that show that. So that's an absolute fact. But the mercury in the vaccines is a different form of organic mercury. It's called ethyl mercury. And the only difference is it's got an extra carbon atom and a couple extra hydrogen atoms. Chemically speaking, the chemists will tell you that these are extremely closely related organic compounds, and above all, they're in the category of the most toxic forms of mercury. So health officials have said, wow, you know, we put mercury in the vaccines, but it is a much, much safer form of mercury. They say that. However, what they say has to be supported by science. And the science that was actually fairly sparse up until recently, there was really no science that showed that ethyl mercury was significantly safer than methylmercury. It crossed the blood-brain barrier. In fact, you only had to look at the manufacturing safety data sheet. They admit that the manufacturers of ethylmercury, thimerosal, will say, this crosses the blood-brain barrier. This is toxic to the developing brain. This will cause nervous system damage. This can cause mental retardation. This can cause attention disorders. This can cause memory impairment. So there's just absolutely no question it's neurotoxic.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. David Abe in discussing this incredible story. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and the point that Dr. Abe has actually made is that if you analyze per kilogram of the child's weight, why, right now, because we, first of all, are giving the child their influenza vaccine when they're 6 months old, and it has mercury in it. And then, of course, when you analyze that they're giving it to the child in utero, and so they're getting the full dose of what their mother is getting, with an influenza vaccine now that is recommended for pregnant women, you know, why, if you calculate this out per kilogram of body weight, the children are getting as much mercury today by the time they're five as they certainly were getting before. But they don't want the American people to know that. In other words, oh, we're so concerned about the children, we've taken out of childhood vaccines. When did they begin recommending that you give the toxic influenza vaccine to pregnant women? Have they done that all along,
well,
or is that something new?
They have done it to a certain degree, but it's very interesting. If you review, going back a couple of decades, of CDC recommendations, and they publish this every year in a report called the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly, there has been a very, very gradual, and I'm sure you're used to this concept, gradual change. So hardly anyone ever notices. And they started, in the early 90s, they said, well, let's just give this to high-risk women, only women with cardiovascular disease. And then they said in about 95, well, you know, we ought to give this to third trimester women because they're, their bellies are big and they have difficulty breathing, so they're a little bit risk if they got the flu. They could be compromised. In 97, they added the second trimester. And the rhetoric gradually got a little stronger, and in 2004, they finally threw caution to the wind and said, you know what, we think every pregnancy, every woman who's pregnant should get this, and they should get it regardless of the trimester of pregnancy.
But, of course, by then there is no question that they knew the terrible toxic effect, you know, the other childhood vaccines upon the minds of the children, and they'd even had meetings where they discussed this sort of thing, and I was talking to Dr. Mark Geyer the other day. He said they even have emails going back and forth, you know, among the people at the CDC saying, you know, how are we going to keep this covered up? Would certainly be, the people could never accept the fact that we've harmed the children. They know what they're doing. That is what's so unconscionable.
Yes, they really do. I don't think there's any question about that. And they've really used the expansion of the flu vaccine in order to get right back in there with these high levels of mercury. And it's been so important to understand the flu and the flu vaccine, because it's state after state who has introduced bills, such as Illinois and California and Iowa, New York, and so forth. The bills are requiring mercury to be removed from the vaccines, but public health officials are saying, hey, we've already taken it out. What's left is such a small, small amount. And the flu vaccine is such a critical part of public health policy. If you restrict the type of vaccines that we can have, the numbers might, the availability could drop, and this could threaten immunization coverage rates, and of course, if we had a pandemic or epidemic, it would be catastrophic. So the health officials have really forced lobbyists and advocates such as myself to understand the flu vaccine science in order to really answer that question. Is it, do these bills that restrict mercury in vaccines, will they threaten influenza coverage rates? And what is influenza vaccine? Is it important? Does it do anything? Is it really critical to public health policy? And so we did this review. Dr. Yazbach and myself published a paper just a few weeks ago in the Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons. And we took on basically that chore. We really wanted to answer the question, several questions that we wanted to answer. Number one, what is influenza illness? How serious is it? In order to support a policy of vaccinating pregnant women, we saw that three criteria had to be fulfilled. That it had to be scientifically proven, these three questions. And it's very simple. Number one, is an influenza illness serious to a pregnancy? In other words, is it a big deal? If you got the flu, does it mean anything? Are you at a greater risk being pregnant with the flu as opposed to being a woman who wasn't pregnant? Because we don't vaccinate non-pregnant women right now. They are low, low risk. So what is the evidence that influenza is a big deal? Number two, does vaccinating a pregnant woman reduce the odds of getting influenza? Common sense question. And the third question is, if these two criteria are fulfilled, of course, mandatory, is it safe? In order to evaluate a risk-benefit, you have to have some idea of what the risks are. So we decided to basically explore those three questions and take a look at the CDC's own publication, because they write a publication every year on numerous things in infectious disease policy and other public health policies. But they write a big paper, and it's 100 plus pages, a couple hundred references. It's called Prevention and Control of Influenza. And this is their formal recommendation by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. And it's pretty well referenced. They basically say, here's why we're giving influenza vaccine to pregnant women, and they claim it's justified. And if you read that, you know, it sounds pretty good. I mean, you would be reasonably convinced. I think the overwhelming majority of physicians pick that up and read it, and they go, well, you know, it sounds like we ought to give pregnant women the flu shot. But one thing that we've learned is you have to look a little bit deeper than on the surface, and any policy has to be based on science. When we started pulling these papers that they cited that supported policy, we found none of the three criteria were even, I think, remotely fulfilled. Not whatsoever. And I think it's a good exercise in deception. I think the most important thing is what's the risk to the pregnancy. And I'll probably cover that last, because I think that's probably the most shocking. But let's go through the first two things. First of all, probably just in order to clarify things, many people get terms confused. So let's define what influenza is, what influenza-like illness is, and what the flu is. When people say they get the flu, that's generally non-specific symptoms. You know, cough, fever, runny nose, aches, basically like a bad cold. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have a specific underlying infection. A lot of viruses can cause flu-like symptoms. Bacteria can cause flu-like symptoms, and you can even get flu-like symptoms from something you ate, a toxin, a drug reaction, and so forth. When you talk about influenza illness, that's specific. That means that you got an illness that was caused by an RNA type of virus, either influenza type A or influenza type B. Very specific. So those two things are used interchangeably. And just for clarification, I think we need to ask one very important question. how frequent is influenza as a cause of influenza-like illness? And you would think, I think most people believe, well, gosh, every time you got the flu, it must be the influenza virus, right? Well, that's not right. The CDC keeps statistics on this, and they publish this. And actually, they report from a couple of large laboratories all the specimens that are submitted to labs for cultures from people who have influenza-like illnesses, cough, fever, so forth. It turns out, in the 5 years that we looked, it was, five seasons ending in 2005, only about 12.5% of the specimens had influenza virus in it. That meant that, you know, and about 80-90% are non-influenza. So if you're going to get a vaccine, my goodness, only about 12% is influenza that's causing the illness. The vaccine can't be more effective more than 12% of the time.
And, of course, that 12% of the time, is it really effective in 100% effective in preventing the influenza? That would be the next question.
Well, there's actually another question there. The vaccine only has three antigens, and there's many strains of vaccine. And it turns out the CDC, who has to guess which strains to put in the flu vaccine, is right about 50% of the time. So now it drops down the effectiveness to maximally about 6-7%. And we know that even if you got a bug that matched the vaccine strain you received, it works about 70-80% of the time. So we're probably talking about 5%. So basically, in general, people that get sick often don't get influenza virus, and the vaccine can't possibly be more effective, more than 5-6% effective in even preventing the disease. So that's pretty staggering statistic right off the top. And then second step, basically analyzing in this, I think, ridiculous policy of vaccinating pregnant women, is influenza illness in pregnancy a big deal? Is there any evidence that women who are pregnant get sick? I mean, really sick, is it a threat, particularly to the developing pregnancy? Is there higher incidence of birth defects, abortions, preterm labor, C-section, things like that? And it turns out there's absolutely no evidence that influenza illness in pregnancy is a big deal. Only about 3-4% of women, while they're pregnant during the flu season, come into the clinic with symptoms of a cold. The hospitalization rates are frankly quite rare. We're talking about 1 to 5 cases per 10,000 pregnancies. Most of those women have comorbidities like asthma. Some of the studies that looked at hospitalization included the delivery. So you really don't know whether they happen to have a cold at the time they came in and they were just jotted down in their hospital chart for coding purposes that they had influenza. So it was quite striking that we found no evidence. Now, the CDC loves to scare people. So they bring up statistics from the 1918 epidemic and say, well, wow, a lot of people died then. Now, can you imagine, Dr. Stan, if you were going to convince, in your specialty, if you were to convince individuals of a new policy to do a hip surgery, and you'd say, gosh, you know, in hip surgery in 1918, we had 70% of the people died, so this procedure is really important. Well, of course not. You know, a lot of things were more serious than 70, 80 years ago in medicine. It's pretty ridiculous to pull statistics from a time when x-rays weren't as good, when the laboratory testing was quite poor, and antibiotics were non-existent or really in their infancy.
And that's absolutely true, and this is the sort of thing they do. They tell you the incidence of death from diphtheria, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century, they don't mention it before. At the time the diphtheria vaccine was released, there were very, very few people dying. And the same thing as far as pertussis and tetanus and so many of the things. They use the wrong statistics. They don't tell you what it was when they introduced the vaccine, but what it was 40 years beforehand. As if they're trying to sell us something. And the question is, what are they trying to sell us? And if it's true, why do they have to sell it? Well, David, pick the story up from there.
Well, just one other study I think I'll cite because it's in your neck of the woods. This is the Kaiser Permanente study that was done in Northern California. They looked at 50,000 pregnant women. 50,000 women. Now, these weren't necessarily public aid. These were insurance patients. So some of the research cited is very often public aid populations, which, of course, have higher comorbidities, and the researchers very often don't control for those comorbidities. But this was one of the largest studies ever done looking at flu in pregnancy. They found out of the 50,000 pregnant women, there was only an influenza illness rate of 1.8 per 10,000 pregnancies. 1.8 cases per 10,000, and that's viral proven. And the hospitalization rate in the basically the 5 years, about 2 hospitalizations per season in a population of 50,000 pregnant women.
That's two hospitalizations for influenza.
Per season for influenza. Now, there was no death in any of these cases. In fact, there was no serious outcomes. We don't really quite know why they were hospitalized. Very often they were hospitalized perhaps for other comorbidity. Maybe they had asthma. Maybe they had broken a rib from, you know, coughing spell or something like that. But there was no specific mention of morbidity or mortality. In fact, that's really the gauntlet here. There's absolutely no modern study that shows any significant morbidity or mortality in pregnant women who get the influenza virus. So it's rather a benign illness. You wouldn't think that by, you know, turning on the television or picking up newspapers, would you?
No, you certainly wouldn't. But then they're trying to scare us to death. Always manipulating us, always trying to frighten us.
That's right. And we talked a little bit about vaccine effectiveness, and that's really the next question. And if you're going to obviously vaccinate the entire country of pregnant women, you would like to know, hey, is this vaccine going to prevent me from getting ill? And the answer to that, in scientifically speaking, in peer-reviewed literature, the answer is no. There's not one single study that shows women that get vaccinated have lower infection rates than those that do not get vaccinated. In fact, 2 studies showed that women are 4 times more likely to report influenza-like illness if they get the flu shot. Pretty amazing. So it makes you wonder that is influenza illness a potential risk?
And of course, you know, I think I don't ever take the flu shots. I never have. But I know so many people who do take the flu shots regularly, and they often report coming down with the flu within a few days to a week or so after they've taken the flu shot. So does the influenza immunization actually tend to produce sometimes flu-like symptoms?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the manufacturers do state that this is a side effect of the vaccine. There's no question about it. And if you looked at VAERS, which is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, you know, there's tens of thousands of reports of illness like this following the flu vaccine. There's really not enough well-controlled studies, in my opinion, to look at. You know, you have to follow these people for a significant period of time, and most of these studies have just very short, 48-hour follow-up, so the safety study is very limited. But anecdotally, I mean, I work in a hospital radiology department, and I speak to several of the employees, and I guess this is antidote, but it seems to me about 50 to 70% of the people I speak with say, you know what, I got the flu shot, and I had the worst flu I have ever had in my life, and I'm never going to take it again. And do you have that experience, too, when you talk to people?
I've heard the same story over and over again, except they usually don't say they're not going to take it again because we have been so indoctrinated that vaccines are good, and anybody who's against vaccines, obviously, you know, is coming out of the dark ages. Vaccines are safe and effective, and we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and David was simply saying that the studies, and there's a large Kaiser Permanente study, 60,000 pregnant women, who were certainly, and they were analyzing how many of them came down with the influenza, you know, during the course of their year of pregnancy, and then how many of them had to be hospitalized. There was only, out of 60,000, just a couple of women who had to be hospitalized specifically for influenza. And then the question is raised, does this really stop the influenza in pregnant women? And there are no studies that show that it does. So if you're pregnant and you take the influenza vaccine, there is no evidence you're really going to benefit from it. And so often, and we've heard this, I know I've heard this from patients, and Dr. Ayoub has as well, people take the influenza shot and they come down with the influenza shortly thereafter. So pick up the story from there.
That's right. Well, going on to our next stage of assessment, in considering this policy of vaccinating all pregnant women in the United States. One of the tactics that you hear is that influenza is a deadly illness, but there has been a great amount of hype on the mortality statistics. The most common figure you hear in media and in medical literature is that about 36,000 people die every year of influenza. The CDC does admit that about 90% of those mortalities are in elderly people. But it's actually extremely hard to validate those statistics. The National Vital Statistics System keeps a list of mortality by cause and by age group, going back many, many years. And we pulled their statistics over the last five seasons that were available to us, going back to 1997 through 2002. And they do something very deceptive, which is no surprise. When they list the cause of death, one of the leading causes of death is a category called influenza and pneumonia. Now, that's a little funny because that's two entities. Of course, influenza being a viral illness and pneumonia being, you know, who knows what. That's an inflammation of the lungs due to usually an infection, mostly bacterial, that occurs not just in the flu season, but occurs off-season. We see pneumonia mostly in hospitalized patients, post-operative patients, AIDS patients, chemotherapy patients, and so forth. So you would predict that if you split that category up, you're not going to see many influenza deaths, but you're going to see a lot more pneumonia deaths. And you're absolutely right. And just to give you a list, in those 5 years we looked at, the combined category of deaths, and this is all ages, is in the 65 to 90,000 range. If you break it down to influenza only, just split away the pneumonia cases, you've got somewhere between 250 and 1,700 deaths per year. And we know 90% of those occur in elderly, right? Now, they break down the category even further, because not all cases of influenza have laboratory confirmation, and that's the definitive diagnosis, where they do a culture, a special test, and they identify the viral antigens or culture it, so they know this is an influenza infection versus another virus. Turns out that most of those aren't laboratory confirmed. So the cases of death, now we broke it down by age now, so how many women in reproductive age, and I picked a category 20 to 39 years of age, have influenza and mortality from influenza proven in the laboratory? Turns out it's between it's between 0 and 1.
That's in the entire country.
That's right. 0 and 1. And those are reproductive age women. I can't tell you who's pregnant and who's not, but if only 0 to 1 women between, you know, age 20 or 39 dies from an influenza infection in the year, in the entire country, probably that person wasn't pregnant, and probably they were immunocompromised.
And of course, then the question is, why then do we want to immunize all pregnant women against influenza when nobody's dying of it?
Well, are
we perhaps hurting the child? If the pregnant woman gets influenza, can it hurt her child in utero? That's the question.
That's the next question. Absolutely. So basically, to summarize where we're at. Number one, we don't think influenza infection is a big deal. In layman's term, we don't think it's a risk to the mother. We don't think it's a risk to the pregnancy. We don't think it's a risk to the delivery outcome. Number two, there's no evidence that vaccination reduces the frequency of influenza-like illness. And there's some evidence to suggest that you get the vaccine when pregnant, you're going to have a 3 to 4 more likelihood of getting an influenza-like illness. Safety. And really, in reality, these first two categories not proven, you know, you could say, you know, you can stop the program. But this is really the nail in the coffin. Is it safe? Now, we'll go back to the CDC policy. What on earth is the CDC citing that's proven that the influenza vaccine is safe to give in pregnancy? This is right from their literature, and this is just perplexing. They quote a study by Heinonen in 1973, they say that about 2,000 women were injected with the influenza vaccine and there were no adverse fetal outcomes. But that's not really what the study showed.
All right, fine. Well, when we get back, we'll want to go over that. We're going to be guest this evening is Dr. David A. We're talking about the CDC policy of mandating that every pregnant woman gets an influenza shot. That probably is not going to do any good, but what about doing any harm? Well, this is Dr. Stan. David, go right ahead and pick the story up there.
Well, the study to support safety actually was a cancer study. They looked at cancer rates in children in the first year of life. In fact, if the fetus would have died, if the child would have been born with a severe brain defect, birth defect, they wouldn't even have been counted in the study as a adverse reaction. They were only looking at cancer rates. And the irony is, the study looked at only 2,000 cases of women who got the flu shot, but they looked at several, about 18,000 cases of women who got the polio vaccine, and they concluded that polio vaccine causes cancer in childhood. I'll say that again. Polio vaccine causes cancer in childhood.
Now, of course, this is if they're giving it to pregnant women, or is that the idea?
That's right. They give it to pregnant women, and children had cancer in the first year of life, probably via the SV40 virus. And the Institute of Medicine, the other irony, the Institute of Medicine looked at this paper and they rejected it. They were doing an immunization safety review committee, looked at the association between polio vaccine and cancer and said, this study has statistical flaws, we reject it.
Now, for our listeners out there, of course, the SV40 was the simian virus 40 that was in the original Sabin and Salk vaccine because it was grown in the cultures of the kidneys of the rhesus, rhesus monkey, and it contained a cancer-producing virus. SV40 produces mesotheliomas in hamsters. And, of course, actually, it is known that SV40 produces cancer in many animals. It would produce a cancer in almost every animal. In fact, SV40 was the first virus that they did a genetic analysis on because they wanted to find out what about SV40 that produced cancer. And yet it was in the polio vaccine that was given to so many people, initially. So pick up the story there.
Well, I guess the biggest disappointment to me or shock is people at the CDC who write this, the people in the advisory committee, don't they think anyone's going to read these citations?
No, probably not. Most people, they accept what they're told. And they don't go back and read the original study any more than the average patient is going to read the package insert and what the actually producer of the product, the pharmaceutical product or vaccine that they're taking, actually says about their product. Very, very few of my patients ever read the package inserts. Believe me, I've got to the point I always read them.
That's right. It's a lot of work, but well worth it, particularly when you realize that there's so many problems we're not being told right off the bat. So we've looked at the literature outside of the ACIP policy paper, and we found a handful of other papers that tried to assess safety. They even would claim that they assess safety, but really...
Hold up right there, David, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. David Aub, and he is simply talking about their analysis of the CDC's justification for the fact that influenza injections in pregnant women was perfectly safe. They had one study, went back to 1973, and they said that this study, 2,000 pregnant women got influenza vaccines, perfectly safe, but the study really had to do with cancer in the first year of life for the children, the offspring of the mothers who got the influenza vaccine. Had nothing to do with the pregnancies, had nothing to do with how many children were born with deformities or aborted, or had nothing to do with the safety of the vaccine. But they figure that most doctors, and certainly most people, aren't going to be, persnickety enough to actually read the study that they're citing. And frankly, when you cite a study that doesn't demonstrate what you say, you're simply lying. And that's what they were doing. So pick up the story. Did you find any other studies that showed that the CDC has proof that influenza shots containing mercury in pregnant women is safe?
Well, we did. It wasn't easy, but we did. There was a... Heinemann, one of the researchers who actually on this polio, influenza vaccine, and cancer study, had been part of a study in Boston in the early 70s called the Collaborative Perinatal Project, Boston Collaborative Perinatal Project. And they looked at tens of thousands of women who were pregnant, followed them prospectively, and made a list of what chemicals they were exposed to and so forth. And they did look at, it wouldn't be the most sound design, but it would produce some signals for potential risks of birth defects. Now, it didn't look at abortion, fetal demise, and so forth. It looked at birth defects only. And we did find reports, as a matter of fact, and they calculated relative risks. For example, influenza virus vaccine was associated with a sevenfold relative risk of cleft palate.
Influenza vaccine, in other words, if the mother got the shot, there was a seven-fold increase, or seven-times increase in the incidence of cleft palate. So obviously, if this is a valid finding, it suggests that the influenza vaccine is somehow influencing the development of the child.
That's right, absolutely. There was also a 2.6 6-fold rise in microcephaly. Now, that's a much more serious birth defect, clearly evidence of neurotoxicity. But, you know, there's something else in this influenza vaccine. That's mercury, our friend thimerosal. And this, these folks also took a look at thimerosal, and it was associated with a wide variety of malformations as well, statistically significant increased risk of birth defects. So that is really a pretty soundly and widely quoted textbook for a variety of medical, biochemical, chemical exposures. So, yeah, clearly there is some evidence of birth defects. But we decided to dig into the ethyl mercury literature because there's really no adequate safety testing. As a matter of fact, if you read the vaccine package inserts, they will tell you, all makers of the influenza vaccine basically say this: we have not tested the influenza vaccine in pregnancy, not in women or not in animals. We don't know whether it's harmful to the mother. We don't know whether it's harmful to the fetus. We don't know whether it's associated with birth defects. We don't know whether it can harm future reproductive capacity. Now, that's a pretty odd statement. Why on earth would anybody inject a pregnant woman if it's never, if the, in the manufacturer's state, it has never been tested, even in animals?
Well, of course, why would, of course, any pregnant woman take it? Unless, of course, she believes that the doctor is telling her the truth. The trouble is the doctor hasn't read those package inserts.
That's right.
And he's simply going along with what the public health officer tells him, and the public health officer is going along with what the CDC tells him, and the CDC is a political organization having very little to do with medicine.
That's right. It turns out that we believe that that package insert is wrong, and because there is evidence that thimerosal is an abortive fashion. It has been tested in animals, and it causes fetal death. And every study that they looked at exposing a pregnant animal to mercury in, as a form of thimerosal, there was always a relationship between the dose and fetal death.
Now, of course, so what are we talking? Are we talking about 1%, 2%, 5% of fetal death in animals?
Well, it, of course, it depends on the doses they gave and the routes and the concentration. So it's a little bit hard to translate from animal study, human study, but you start with the animal studies because these studies go back to 1972. Gassett in 1975, they just dropped basically thimerosal into the peritoneum inside the abdominal cavity of rats or on the lining of the eye, the conjunctiva, in rabbits, and they found the increased risk was up to 35-fold. 35-fold risk of fetal death. No question it was a dose response. Etoy in 1972 reproduced this in rabbits, had up to a 5-fold increase in fetal death versus the control group that just got saline. And a researcher by the name of Digger in 1987 did this study in chicken embryos, found a 5-fold increase in fetal death. So the point is that thimerosal is a known animal abortifacient experimentally. That makes the manufacturing basically in violation of federal and state Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. Because thimerosal is a component of the vaccine, and these federal acts state that in defining toxicity of the drug, you have to take in consideration all components and even the vial. If the cork was toxic, if the plunger was toxic, that's part of the drug, and you have to report that as toxicity with the drug. So there's no question thimerosal is toxic experimentally, and the drug inserts flatly state, we haven't tested this. We don't know what it's going to do in pregnant animals, and that's completely wrong.
In other words, they're lying.
They're lying.
But then, of course, the government's going right along with this because, after all, aren't there too many people in the world? In fact, you kept talking about 1972. That was the year, of course, that the Club of Rome came out with their book, Limits of Growth, stressing the importance of population control. And then just 2 years after that, why, that we have Henry Kissinger talking about patting out the National Security Study Memorandum 200, stressing the importance of population control. We know in 1969, Dr. Day, medical director of Planned Parenthood, was talking about how there are too many people in the world. We're just going to have to kill them off, create new diseases, suppress findings, treatments for cancer. And anybody would like to hear the background of that discussion. It's in a four-tape set, The New Order of the Barbarians. 2 months later, Dr. David MacArthur went before the House Appropriations Committee on Military Affairs, asked for $10 million to create a new disease. for which there'd be no immune response, a new method of mass killing. Well, we want to go ahead and develop it anyway. So it was in that period, 1969, 1972, 1974, tremendous stress on eliminating human life here in America and throughout the world, of course.
That's right. And certainly mercury fulfills the population control agenda because it does diminish future reproductive function. We know it's toxic to cilia, and cilia are the small hairs that make sperm motile. It makes the fallopian tube function. And experimentally, when you apply thimerosal to sheep trachea, it completely arrests or kills ciliary function. So we suspect that there's a very significant increased risk of reproductive failure in individuals who get exposed to this, particularly early in life. Children who had Pink's disease, for example, which is a poisoning from mercury-tainted teething powders in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and mostly in England and Australia. When those children, if they survived childhood, grew up, there was a very high incidence of infertility. And experimentally, animals who are exposed to mercury, both male and female animals, have altered reproductive function. In other words, they have gonadal dysfunction, they have testicular atrophy, reproductive behavior is diminished. And the interesting thing is, even those animals who are able to reproduce and produce smaller litter sizes, for example, the next generation of animals are even affected as well. They produce less. So this affects the genes. It's toxic to the genetic material in animals who are exposed to this. So really frightening. There is some evidence that flu vaccine has done damage in pregnancy. And we should mention this, and this wasn't part of this paper. This was part of our analysis we did subsequent to the paper, and we took a look at the government's own database once again, and this is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System.
That's known as VAERS.
VAERS, exactly. And we took a look at, and that's available on the Internet. It's a public version. I'm sure there's a private version somewhere, but the public version is searchable. You can go into it yourself, go to the CDC's website. We took a look and just basically put in flu vaccine as the agent given, and we wanted to know how many reports of this vaccine were given to pregnancy, and was it associated with these terms, fetal demise, abortion, fetal death, stillbirth, birth defect, and so forth. And since VAERS inception, I think in the early 90s, we found 16 reports of fetal death following a flu vaccine. Now, that in and of itself may not sound that impressive, but you got to remember, the average immunization coverage rate in pregnant women is less than 1% up until recent years, when it's about probably 8 to 10% right now. But it was very infrequently given during this period of time, and it's very underreported. So this represents probably 100th to 1,000th of the true cases.
And, of course, people this don't understand. VAERS is a voluntary reporting, and most women who have an abortion, they're not going to report it, and the doctor isn't going to report it. After all, especially if he's the one that has been treating the case, he'd certainly never want to suggest that something he had done had killed that unborn child. So the chances of it being reported, I think, are pretty slim, aren't they?
Oh, they're very, very small. They quote 5%, well, we think it's a fraction of that. And, you know, doctors have been told, hey, this is safe, don't worry about it. So a physician will tell a patient who lost a baby, oh, don't worry about it, can't be the vaccine. But here's really the strong evidence in this database. In 2005, in December, now there was only five reports in the year 2005 so far of deaths following a flu vaccine. Four of the five reports occurred in North Carolina. They occurred on the same day. There were shared lots. So in other words, some of these cases came from the same lot. The pregnancies were in the second and third trimester. Now, spontaneous abortions occur when? First trimester. Very uncommon in the second and third trimester. This is called a temporal and geographical cluster. The CDC, actually the safety officers, write papers on how to data mine the VAERS database. They will tell you, you look for geographical and temporal clusters. This points to causality. Four out of five cases in 2005 were in the same state on the same day, same vaccine lot. This is evidence, and it's strong evidence, that the flu vaccine has caused fetal death in this country. This needs to stop. This recommendation of an unnecessary vaccine for a mild illness in a vaccine not tested for safety, this has to be pulled.
And of course, even that, even more frightening is the fact that, at least in the animal studies, it markedly increased the incidence of abortion. Isn't that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So we think this is a, and we see this as a formal, you know, plea for them, for whether at the state level, at the local level. I don't think anything's going to happen at the federal level. This is an insane policy to inject pregnant women with mercury intentionally for nothing.
But of course, you know, in the states where they're trying to get the all of the thimerosal removed from the vaccines, there's tremendous pressure, isn't there, from the people in government, you know, opposing that, and who else is opposing it?
Oh, the American Academy of Pediatrics is way up there on your list. They are opposing very stiff opposition at the state levels. They are lobbying senators, congressmen, health committees. They're saying, look, this is going to devastate health care policy in the state. We're going to have outbreaks of influenza in children and women. You cannot allow this mercury ban to pass because it's going to devastate the supply. And that is absolutely false. There is enough thimerosal-free flu vaccine to vaccinate all 6 to 23-month-olds in the United States. The manufacturers have the capacity of doubling thimerosal-free flu vaccine. You know why they haven't doubled it yet? They've never sold out. They've never sold out. Nobody, states aren't ordering it. In fact, Illinois passed a bill last year, went in effect in January. The Illinois Public Health, 6 months before the bill was enacted, decided they were going to file an exemption. They never told any of the Illinois providers. No physician, no hospital, no clinic knew that there was a mercury ban in Illinois. Physicians didn't order it. They didn't know. And when January came around, the public health filed an exemption, and they got help from who? The CDC.
And, of course, the thing is that mercury is toxic to the brain. And, of course, it's toxic, you know, the more mercury you have at a younger age, you know, the higher the dose per unit of, or kilogram of weight or ounces of weight, and you do tremendous, immeasurable harm to the brain. Ladies and gentlemen, 1 in 6 American children, by the CDC's own statistics, has some sort of a neurodevelopmental abnormality. You don't see this in other countries. Why do we see it here? And where is the outcry from organized medicine? The average doctor doesn't know about it. He doesn't hear programs like this. And the people in the highest levels of government who know exactly what's going on don't want the public to learn. Who would want to hurt our children? Some of the people that I believe working at the Centers for Disease Control have a different worldview, have a different agenda. What better way to destroy a great nation than to destroy the brains and minds of their children? Could anything be that evil? And that's the question. And I would like to suggest, well, just keep listening to our programs. David, go right ahead.
Well, if listeners want to download a copy of this article, it is available free on the Internet, and I would suggest that you take a copy or copies of this to your doctor's office, whether you're a family practitioners, obstetrician, or local health officials, and increase awareness. Let them know that this is a potentially risky policy. It's been challenged now in the peer-reviewed literature. And you can get a copy of this article at Journal of American Physician and Surgeon website, and that's jpands.org, www.jpands.org.
Now that's a Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons.
That's right. And I hope I said that right. I think it's JPANDS, yes. But if I misspoke, you can just Google Journal of American Physician and Surgeons, and you can find that easily.
And when will that be actually published?
It's published.
And it is already
about
published.
Several weeks ago.
All right, fine. And certainly Dr. Yazbek did that along with you. We've had Dr. Yazbek on here in the past, and he's certainly a great crusader trying to get the truth out about this fact that we're harming children. And we're harming mothers as well, I fear. But, you know, I guess the thing is that why would anybody be pushing for a mercury-containing vaccine to be given to a pregnant woman when you know it's going to be concentrated in the brain of her unborn child, in the mind of her unborn child? And certainly the studies are there, and Dr. Ayoub and Dr. Yazbek have done a tremendous amount of work getting the information. What can people do? How can we get this information out?
Well, you know, I think that we have so much resistance at the upper levels. I believe that the most effective way to to do this is really word of mouth, grassroots involvement. Talk to your friends. If you have physician friends, nurses, nurse friends, anybody you see who's family members who's pregnant and so forth, warn them about the risk of the flu vaccine in pregnancy.
And then, of course, many of the states are trying to get this legislation through. I know we have it here in California, don't we?
Well, you actually, and it's going to be very interesting what's going to happen in California, because you're the next state up that's going to enact this bill, which really starts this fall. So I'm very curious on what's going to happen in the state of California.
All right. Well, our guest has been Dr. David Aobin. We'll be back in just a minute to wrap up the program. Well, David, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Well,
it's really been quite an experience as you've gotten into this, hasn't it?
Yes, it is. It is very interesting. And just to summarize for listeners that might have joined late, flu vaccine in pregnancy, we've discovered by reviewing the literature and even the citations provided by our own Centers for Disease Control, we've found that influenza illness is not a serious illness. It is not a serious illness to pregnancy. We don't think pregnancy is an immunocompromised state, so why should a viral illness in pregnancy be serious? We couldn't find evidence. Number two, we found no evidence that getting a vaccine, influenza vaccine in pregnancy, prevents influenza. In fact, there may be a risk of getting influenza illness if you get the vaccine. Number three, there's certainly inadequate safety testing, practically non-existent safety testing for the flu shot. The manufacturers will even admit that there's no safety testing, but we do know a dangerous component of most of these flu vaccines contain thimerosal, which is a ethyl mercury-containing compound, and that has been clearly shown to cause abortions in animals. We believe, looking at the CDC's own data, there's evidence that flu shots given in America have caused fetal death in women who have received these vaccines. We don't have an accurate number because there's been no studies that do adequate prospective analysis of this, and that needs to be done. And we would encourage you to download the article and get this to your physicians, get this to your friends, and spread the word, because really the truth isn't coming down from the top down. It's got to come out from the bottom, from people in the trenches who are finding the truth.
Now, Chris, I think that the important thing is that people are going to have to realize they cannot believe what they're being told. You know, they're going to have to begin doing a work and analysis and study on their own, because their health and the health of their family is their responsibility. It's unfortunate, but most of the doctors have no idea what we're talking about. They blindly follow along with, if you're a pediatrician, with the American Academy of Pediatrics. But if you really wanted to do harm to children, where would you work? You'd work within the hierarchy of the American Journal of Pediatrics and the American, American Medical Association, the American Dental Association. There you would be able to influence the policies, would become the public health policies that would do the most damage. Is that what's going on? I can't say. All I can say is look and see what's happening and ask yourself, why is 1 in 6 American children, according to the CDC, have a neurodevelopmental abnormality? And if that indeed is true, why, what are you going to do to help Dr. Aob and the others out there trying to get the truth out? David, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
And thank you for doing all the hard work that I imagine a lot of long hours at nighttime going through all this.
Well, I think it's well worth it.
It is. God bless. Good night.
God bless you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course I hope that you'll want to get copies of the tape and analyze it. You'll check out the article in the Journal of the American Physicians and Surgeons. That's the Journal of the American Physicians and Surgeons. Dr. Aob and Dr. Yazbek's article. We'll have to get Dr. Yazbek on to of course give us more information on that. We did a wonderful interview the other day with certainly Dr. Mark Geyer, and there's treatment now for many of these autistic children. And the organized medicine is doing everything they can to discourage treatment. And if you remember maybe about 3 or 4 months ago, a series of articles in all the major controlled media, Time Magazine, U.S. News, Newsweek Magazine, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and certainly on radio, all about autism and with a plea, but of course there's nothing that could be done about it. And of course, chelation is harmful and potentially harmful. And well, one thing, we don't know the cause of the epidemic of autism, but we can assure you it has nothing to do with thimerosal. Somebody's coordinating the information you're getting. you really need, of course, to get that latest interview we have with Dr. Mark Geyer. It was done just a couple of days ago. They're dramatic treatments. I mean, amazing treatments, amazing reversal, and some of even the children 10 or 11 years of age have almost had a miraculous recovery from this terrible disease, which is iatrogenic, which is being intentionally produced. They know, the CDC knows what they're doing, but they're afraid to let the American people know. I mean, after all, how would you feel if you knew that they were intentionally harming the children? And now with a new recommendation encouraging the flu influenza shot in women in the first trimester, we're going to be able to do the maximum harm. Ladies and gentlemen, understand, we're up against organized evil. If you haven't gotten my video or DVD on planned population reduction, you need to get it. That's planned population reduction. You need to get our 4-tape set on population control, our video on population control. Go to our website and pull down my Population Control Agenda Monograph. It's free up on my website of RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Or you can, of course, get a printed copy of that if you get anything else and ask for a free copy. Why, we'll be glad to get it to you. If you'd like to get a free copy of our latest newsletter on immigration and who is really behind this whole effort to change the culture of our society from an American society into a bilingual, multicultural society. These things are not happening by accident. There are people who have a different worldview because they worship a different God. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. And certainly you can get the DVD, the video, but we recommend certainly the book as a source, because you can check all the information out and find if I'm really telling you the truth. Who's behind this? Who energizes these wealthy and powerful people who really control America, indeed, who control the world? If you'd like to get any of the items we've talked about or more information, call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Go to our webpage at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. We do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family and helping us. And finally, pray for America. Pray for revival. But please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And we'll be back shortly. this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills, overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of my guest, and, of course, the views of our callers. Our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please do not put a call in unless, of course, we specifically ask for calls, because we have with us on the line now from Oregon, Jerry Guidetti, and, of course, she's from the Ark Institute that produces heirloom seeds, or heritage seeds, but we're going to be, of course, talking about what's going on in the world. We're going to be talking about the fact that certainly there the country today already faces the possibility of a very real famine, because certainly the food supplies that we've had, abundant food supplies for a year or 2 years, are all dissipated. And then I'm sure Jerry will want to talk a little bit about what's happening to the influenza epidemic throughout the world, the avian epidemic. So without further ado, Jerry Guidetti, thank you so very much for being with us again.
It's always a pleasure, Dr. Stan. It's good to be here. How are you tonight?
I'm doing just fine, thanks.
Great.
All right, fine. Well, of course, last time we were talking, you talked a lot about the fact that the food supplies, we ordinarily think we have mammoth amounts of grain and corn and all of these things, nothing to worry about. We can never have a food shortage. Well, we might have it over in Africa. We might have it in Indonesia someplace, but this could never happen in America, or could it?
Oh, it certainly can. As a matter of fact, the cards seem to be lining up in that direction, and nobody would like to put it as succinctly as that in official positions, but I'll run down the facts and you can be the judge yourself. We're now looking at carryover stocks. We're projecting carryover stocks, which are those stocks that are left in the bin, grain left in the bin from this year's harvest to carry us over the winter and summer until next year's harvest comes in. That's carryover stocks. This is the lowest carryover stocks we have had, 56 days worth, since 1972. And in 1972, we had precious fewer people here in this country. As a matter of fact, this year, it was just announced yesterday, this year, the United States will have a population of 300 million people. And last I had looked, it was something like 286 to 291. A large portion of that bump up is immigration, of course. And so now we have 300 million people going to be here this year. We are down to the shortest buffer in carryover stocks or grain supplies for the world in for 56 days worth since 1972. Now in 1972, that triggered the doubling of grains prices. But keep in mind, we have something very different at work here. We not only have a much greater population, we also are very very dependent now upon crops being raised every single year to raise genetically modified seeds in order for us to grow next year's crop from those seeds, because they're no longer non-hybrid, they're no longer self-producing of the same varieties, breeding true to themselves. You have to have these produced every single year. But in addition to that, we are using roughly 60% of our harvest every year around the world for food. 36%, add them up, that's 96%. 36% is feed in order to grow animals for food. So we're looking at 96% of all the grain worldwide used for food. 3% of it currently is used as fuel, except the United States now is growing corn for ethanol production to put in gas tanks, and the increase in corn needed for ethanol production has been 20% a year. And now we have politicians lining up for the next elections, already touting ethanol as the answer to our oil dependency. And in fact, we cannot sustain enough growth in production and carryover for the food end of this equation, let alone robbing from Peter to pay Paul, if you will, to put it in our gas tanks instead of in our mouths. So the question is, do you want to eat it or run your car on it? Do you want to have food on your table or do you want to drive an SUV? We can't have it all. Unfortunately, we'd like to believe so. We've lived in, as you've pointed out many times, we've lived in a most blessed time. We have lived a very opulent life compared to other cultures, other times. But in fact, it's coming home to rest. We are going to have to pay the piper now because we are now exporting or consuming, exporting out of this country to try to make money for this country. We are importing more in order to have enough to eat. We are actually net importing grains, even though we're selling some abroad. We are importing largely from Canada. We get a lot from Brazil, too, from South America, where much of our seed is produced. And that brings us to another whole issue. But the other thing, Stan, that we have to talk about is the fact that all of this huge production that our politicians are saying is going to answer our need for oil and gasoline, that production is, in fact, dependent upon oil, gasoline, and natural gas to feed the farm equipment, to manufacture the herbicides and pesticides, and the natural gas to make all of that fertilizer for these highly productive hybrids and genetically modified plants in order to grow them optimally to get the best or the greatest amount of biomass.
And of course, really, the whole fertilizer industry, and so much of this is simply dependent on petroleum products.
Absolutely.
Isn't that right?
Yes, that's correct. The entire fertilizer industry is dependent upon petroleum products and herbicides as well, and pesticides as well.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Jerry Guidetti here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jerry Guidetti, and we're simply talking about the fact that if you really look and see what's happening as far as the food supplies in the world are concerned, we have about a little over 70 days of grain available at the present time. But, of course, so much of the fertilizer and the other things that are so necessary, the pesticides that are necessary to modern farming, are really dependent on petroleum. And we see the dramatic increase in the price of petroleum and petroleum products having almost doubled here over the last couple of years. And, of course, that's going to have to be passed on to the cost of agriculture. So pick up the story there, Jerry.
Sure. In addition to the fact that we are dependent on petroleum, gasoline, natural gas and so on for agriculture, for modern agriculture, we are also 100% dependent upon water to feed that massive increase in production that they're looking forward to doing. Now, that's very optimistic. They're thinking we're going to be able to plant, fence post to fence post, corn everywhere. We're going to fertilize them to death because they are very high users of nitrogen. You need to have high nitrogenous fertilizers, which, of course, are largely obtained from natural gas supplies and urea and so on. They're expecting to be able to do this when, in fact, this year, because of dropping production per acre here in the United States, productivity rather, because of poor weather conditions, because of burned out land, marginal soils, because of increasing deserts in some areas of the country and dropping water tables, we are already going to see this year 61 million metric tons shortfall in what we need just to eat with the numbers of people we have in the world now, today, when in fact we're going to be looking at 70 million people a year increasing, the numbers of people per year added to the earth is 70 million people. Where is all that water going to come from to water all of that additional acreage that they expect to grow not only food on, but now ethanol for the United States? The United States is the consumer of ethanol as a fuel, and we're looking to increase that at least 20% a year. How are we going to do that when, in fact, the Ogallala Aquifer and aquifers around the world are dropping so low that it takes deeper and deeper wells? In fact, Stan, what we're doing is we are using, to produce ethanol, we are using the water that your grandchildren, my child and grandchildren, will need in the future just to drink, just to provide the barest essentials for themselves. We are taking the water and the food out of their mouths today by the poor decisions we are making as a country and even as individuals today. And that's where we all have to kind of search our souls and say, are we truly entitled? Everybody would probably argue yes, or at least when I see surveys done where people are asked, are they entitled to have two SUV family, three SUV family, big Hummers and so on? They say, yes, indeed, we are. We are the richest nation in the world, the greatest nation in the world, da-da-da-da. In fact, if they did a little reading, they did a little soul-searching, they did a little honest study, they'd find out that we are the most bankrupt nation, perhaps, the greatest debtor nation in the world.
And, of course, the thing is, Jerry, that this is going to take care of itself in the very near future,
oh,
because
yes,
the whole thing is going to come down. If you go to China today, the people are saving 50% of their income, and their incomes are nowhere near as large as ours, but these people are saving up for their future because they know they cannot look to the government to take care of them, and since because of the one-child policy, you know, there is only one son, and what happens to him? Or if they have a daughter, they'll have nobody to look after them. So people save in other countries throughout the world. The savings rate in here in the United States is actually negative. And this whole thing is coming down because, although, as Jerry said, we're the greatest military power in the world, we are also the largest debtor. And as a nation, we're borrowing well over $2 billion. Some people say $2.5 billion. Some people say $3 billion every single day just to maintain the stability of our society. And in 17 years, when, of course, the Social Security Fund is putting out more than it's taking in, then people go to the Social Security Trust Fund to get the money that's stored there. They're going to find there's nothing there but government IOUs, and the government doesn't have any money. It's all a sham. It's all a scam.
Right.
So I really think that, you know, people are living way beyond their means now.
And our point
to people is just simply get out of debt, get rid of those things that you cannot afford to have, and begin to, of course, preparing for, because I think they're going to be very difficult times, and I believe they're coming very soon. And all we can do is tell you what we know is going to happen. You've got to begin making preparation for yourself. Because believe me, when this whole house of cards comes tumbling down, Big Brother's not going to be there to help you.
Well, they've just about said that, too. After Katrina, you know, Secretary of Health and Human Services, Leavitt, Michael Leavitt, is going around the country talking about the potential for the bird flu pandemic to hit pretty soon. And the reality is, the message he is saying in every single state is, there will be no cavalry coming to the rescue. And he does point out the fact that every state, every county, every city, every individual is going to be responsible for doing the best they can with next to nothing, because the federal government isn't going to be helping you out other than trying to develop vaccines and so on. They're not going to be able to help you out. Well, you can take that same logic and you can expand it to all of these other issues that are coming out. The collateral damage, we're looking at, in a best-case scenario this year, 61 million tons short, only 56 days of grain left in the kitty to carry us through to next year's harvest, when, in fact, we're not looking at best possible outcomes now. We're looking at a hurricane season that is supposed to be as bad as or worse than last year, taking more and more land out of commission, and also placing societies, local societies, in tremendous stress, demanding, of course, as much resources to the area as possible to try to provide them some relief. And then you layer on top of that the fact that bird flu has indeed mutated in Indonesia, just as I had predicted, 4 to 6 weeks ago was going to be the finding. It did mutate. In fact, it mutated in the little boy who passed it to his dad. It was a tertiary passage. Don't forget, it went human to human to human. And unfortunately, it appears from the sequences that the dad was co-infected. He had another virus at the same time, something we have dreaded, because there were so many changes, a total of 11 changes, genetic changes, in that passage from to the little boy and from boy to dad. And those changes apparently played a role in the ability for this virus to infect this third, this tertiary or third layer of humans.
But Jerry, of course, it really didn't it killed those people, but it really hasn't spread beyond that point.
Okay, now here's the question. It's an excellent point. World Health Organization will say, we don't know that the mutations were significant in that they didn't efficiently transfer outside the family. Now, do we know that that's the case? As soon as this cluster arose, they blanketed the area with Tamiflu. Nurses, doctors, neighbors, everybody who came in contact with. Now, it has a prophylactic or preventative function, Tamiflu. Will we ever know if those people actually did receive the virus and would have developed it if Tamiflu wasn't there? We don't know. We do know that China admitted, unfortunately, a paper was released stating that a man that they had claimed died of SARS in 2003 had not died of SARS. In fact, he died of H5N1 in 2003. China has been very, very nervous over the new cases that are occurring in people who have not had exposure to sick chickens that they know of. The chickens, for that trekker, for example, were well in the communities that he passed through. And this is a huge city, by the way. When I saw a picture of Shenzhen, I was picturing some little backwater village, wrong skyscrapers. This is where the man, this trucker, went through. And there were no sick chickens there. These chickens had been vaccinated and so on. China is so nervous, in fact, that it just put out this morning a new regulation, new law, that any newspaper in China that publishes any new information, whether it be about public health issues, military issues, whatever, without passing it through the Chinese government, they will be fined $12,000 U.S. for every single story they publish. They are coming down like a heavy hammer on all freedom of press, all free speech, all centered around this bird flu outbreak. It is breaking out in China, and just yesterday we found out a second wave has just hit, and a big wave has just hit Tomsk, Siberia. This is where we are very concerned, the birds spreading throughout Siberia. Russia will end up here.
But, of course, there's not necessarily in the people in Siberia, is it?
In Siberia, it has not infected people at this point.
And
it is in other countries.
At least in Indonesia, where they seem, even if it was the Tamiflu that blanketed the area, they did exactly what they did with smallpox. And they simply, if there was a case of smallpox, they vaccinated everybody in the area, so it didn't spread. And that's what they did with Tamiflu, which I think was a very, very smart thing to do. Now, there apparently were seven or eight people in that family.
There were eight people in the family, yes, and the first one was buried. The mom was buried without testing her. They didn't know what she died of.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with Jerry Bonetti of the Arc Institute. All right. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly we have a family of eight that if they're in Indonesia. But, you know, at least fortunately, it apparently appears to have gone from person to person in that cluster, but at least it's not spread from there because they blanketed the area. Maybe other people did come in contact with it, but that's the reason they put the Tamiflu out, was to prevent its further spread. And so at least right now there's been no further spread in Indonesia that we know of, is there, Jerry?
In Indonesia, we have lots of spread in Indonesia.
But
we have
person,
it all
but person
well,
to person, I'm talking this, about. I'm
okay.
talking about person to
we
person.
We don't know the answer to that question. We have it breaking out all over in Indonesia. It's, 1,700 islands. It is all over Indonesia. Indonesia has lost control over it. And until they can monitor all of the other cases, they don't know how many other human-to-humans might exist, human-to-human clusters. They are now trying. The meeting was just held on Wednesday. They asked for help. Finally, Indonesia plead for help because they are basically very private. They don't want foreign governments in there, foreign people in there helping them out. They kick them out as fast as they invite them in. Well, now they had a big meeting, and they have told them that they have to kill off all the poultry because basically it's in 33 provinces of Indonesia out of, I'm going to lose the number, out of 42 or something like that. At any rate, it is basically in all of Indonesia, and it is in humans as well as in birds, and we don't have enough Tamiflu in the world to blanket large outbreaks. So far, we've been able to delay the inevitable, what appears to be the inevitable spread. We've been able to delay it by blanketing with Tamiflu, but in fact, in China and in Vietnam and in Indonesia, if we were to have large simultaneous outbreaks or even just large outbreaks in one of those places, we would not be able to get there fast enough to blanket the entire area. Don't forget, the Tamiflu blanket approach is basically to slow it down. We know that we're not going to be able to stop it. We just want to slow it down to buy us time to produce a vaccine. But the mutations that happened in the Karo cluster, that's K-A-R-O cluster, the mutations were so numerous that it appears that we now have two very distinct H5N1s just there in that Karo cluster region of the country. And so any vaccine attempt to inoculate people all over the country against the human form would have to include at least those two types of H5N1, because those are different than the ones that have been found in Siberia. Those are different from the ones found in other areas of Indonesia. This baby is mutating every single day with all different kinds of passages through animals. Cats, by the way, the ones in cats had very much homology or similarity in the sequence as the human father did, who got it from his son. Now the question is it possible that a cat was part of the vector picture in this case? We don't know the answer to that question, but there has been suspicion around the world that we should be looking at cats more closely. Unfortunately, we're having enough trouble, Stan, just getting bird samples. You know, look at what happened in Canada last week. We were waiting for those results, waiting for the results. It came out H5 positive up in Prince Edward Island.
Hold that right there. Sure. Hold that right there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jay Gradetti. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Jerry certainly supports Radio Liberty, and we appreciate that. We appreciate having her on and keeping us abreast of these scientific studies and what's really going on in the rest of the world and how many people have actually died that we know of throughout the world.
Okay, the latest number is... I'm losing track because it's happening every day. I believe it's 138 dead.
That's just the year 2003, is it?
Those are only that's World Health Organization verified. It is not the Chinese countryside. It is not the Indonesian countryside. We know for a fact, as a matter of fact, who will now say it, WHO will now say it, that there is a minimum of that many dead because they know there are many more dead. They're all the unreported. As a matter of fact, Hong Kong right now is on the warpath. They are so worried about the undiagnosed cases of pneumonia. And I heard of this firsthand. I think I relayed that story to you about 8 months ago, where I met someone here outside the Arc Institute in Oregon who had just come back from China. I was astounded to hear he had just come back from China. He is a male nurse. He was visiting hospitals over in China, and he asked them how they're doing with the bird flu problem, and the doctors in the hospitals literally told him, and he went to three hospitals, they have no idea how they're doing because they have so many cases of complex undiagnosed pneumonia that they never bother running diagnosis on it to see what caused it, because they have so many people moving into the cities to work in highly polluted cities. They tend to get pneumonia. They have so many smokers. They have so many other diseases, lung cancer and so on, that they don't bother diagnosing the pneumonia. So now Hong Kong knew this. Hong Kong's docs had said it is all over China. And so they're gathering up all these all the data that they can on undiagnosed pneumonias. And what they're saying, the first day they found 92 cases. Just the first day. This is a potential explosion.
Because they found are these diagnoses H5N1, or are they simply
H5N1 is what they're looking for.
No, but you say they had 90 cases. Were they H5N1, or they were simply people with pneumonia?
These are people who have what can be. Don't forget H5N1. You end up with pneumonia.
You're right, because other things will cause it. So with these people, don't know the H5N1.
So that's right. So they don't know if it's H5N1.
Okay.
These people have been buried with pneumonia. They have died of pneumonia, of complicated pneumonia and severe respiratory distress, which is what this leads to. And most pneumonias, or many pneumonias, can end up as severe respiratory distress. So what is it, SARS? Severe acute respiratory syndrome. In fact, H5N1 produces the same kind of thing. So we don't know how many real cases. Now China has put a lid on all stories being released from the country that are novel events. No new stuff is allowed to be announced to the global community, or you will get fined $12,000 per story. They're clamping down on their own writers, on journalists, on the internet, on everything.
But I have to ask yourself, Jerry, why are they doing that? In other words, why are they so afraid of the information coming out about
Olympics? Olympics?
All right, that's a good explanation.
Yes.
No, that's in 2008, isn't it?
That's correct. And what happens if the world gets wind of the fact? And don't forget exports. Exports, all the stuff they're exporting to other countries. In Taiwan, they opened a couple of cargo boxes from China and found H5N1 contaminated birds and eggs in the boxes. Was that done on purpose, or was that a big oopsie? Now, China doesn't want that out. It did come out. Their own press printed it.
In other words, they actually were exporting infected birds to Taiwan.
Oh, yes, into Taiwan. Oh, yes. And that was months ago. And Taiwan immediately put the kibosh on taking any products from China, any live anything, any chickens, anything, because they realized that they weren't being forthcoming and they weren't checking the flocks out. And so they ended up with H5N1 in these shipping crates.
Now, I'd heard that they were doing widespread vaccination of their chickens over there. Is that still the case?
Yes, as a matter of fact, they're using very faulty vaccines, and they were also giving amantadine, which is why the virus developed resistance to amantadine, which is one of the cheapest antivirals that we had at our disposal. But then the viruses emerge resistant to amantadine, and now they've got chickens running around over there carrying H5N1, but they look healthy. And so people are eating them, and this is just ensuring that it's going to spread.
I will be back in just a moment or two with Jerry Gaudette. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. I guess this evening is Jerry Guidetti, and Jerry, of course, is sharing her concerns about the avian influenza that certainly is in birds all over the world today. And have they actually arrived in Canada yet?
Yes. Well, not the Shanghai Lake variety. We know that we have low pathogenic avian influenza, H5N1. They found that months ago in Canada. We know that we had H5 diagnosed in Prince Edward Island. I started mentioning that again before. We have been waiting for those sequences to be released. They have not been released. However, they shipped the samples off to Winnipeg. The farmer who discovered the staggering geese, four goslings, staggering one day, dead the next, foolishly, he threw away three of them and sent one off to be tested. Okay, they tested it in Prince Edward Island's laboratory and came up H5 positive, immediately sent the sample off to Winnipeg. Apparently, the shipping didn't go well. It took a while to get there. By the time it got there, there was so much degradation of the sample that Winnipeg couldn't find it anymore. So now we're stuck with the results that we had in H5, supposedly cannot find the N out at all, whether it's H5N1. And so they put out a press release saying that if it was H5N1, it was the low pathogenic, just like the others were low pathogenic last year. But keep in mind that that's exactly how it started in Asia, China, Vietnam, Thailand, so on. It all started as low-path H5N1. It then undergoes recombination and some reassortment perhaps as well and becomes the high pathogenic. High to whom? High to poultry first. Usually it happens around areas where there is some high-density human activity raising poultry. Apparently it's how we raise poultry that is contributing to the evolution of this virus, and it passes from our factory-produced poultry or backyard poultry into the wild population. And unfortunately, last year, I think I released that information on your program, there were suddenly some 7,000 or so barheaded geese dropped dead on Qinghai Lake in China. And it was Baxun, the underground newspaper in China, that released the photographs and the information.
Hold that thought, Jerry. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Jerry Guidetti, and we're simply talking about what's happening with the avian flu epidemic. But before we go on, first of all, I want to announce our telephone number, which is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But Jerry, I do want you to get out your address, your website, because sure. Of course Jerry is with the Ark Institute, and they have wonderful seeds that you can. These are certainly heirloom seeds, and of course they are not been genetically modified, and of course Jerry will teach you how to grow your crops, and then of course how to ensure that you have the seeds for the following year. And she has books on that, saving seeds, growing crops, and anyway, why don't you tell people how to get in touch with you?
Sure, it's 1-800-255-1912, 1-800-255-1912, or ARK institute.com. All is one word, arkinstitute.com. If you don't want to do that, you could always send a letter to the ARK Institute at P.O. Box 1721, 1721, Gold Beach, Oregon, 97444, because some people don't have computers and don't like to use telephones. Again, P.O. Box 1721, Gold Beach, Oregon, 97444. And we should make a point, Stan, that the reason it's so important now for people to at least plan for the potential of famine here in this country, and gosh, that sounds like an exaggeration, and that sounds like this lady's an alarmist. Well, if it means I'm sounding an alarm to let you know that we are that this can happen, that this can happen in the near term, not the long term, then so be it. I'm an alarmist. It's really important for people to understand that all with the what I told you about the government's figures and world crop specialist figures, that we've got 56 days worth of food in the grain bins around the world. That is so critical because it means that we cannot afford a single season without massive production of food. Now, what are the things that could interrupt a season? Avian influenza is probably one of the biggest threats right now. I would place that up there even with bioterrorism that could knock out massive amounts of people around the world or agricultural crops around the world. Then very close to the top would be all of the changes in temperature. If we go up 1 degree Celsius, we lose 10% of grain production around the world. We are looking at weather changes. All you have to do is ask the people in the east. They're all underwater over there, the whole Mid-Atlantic region, several states, all underwater. This is very abnormal weather. We are in either in a cycle or we're seeing the direct results of our activities on the earth. Whichever one pans out, it doesn't make any difference. It is happening. If we miss one season or even miss half of a season's production, we are in trouble. Japan has already put out messages in their newspapers that people should expect to have food shortages in Japan. They are the most dirt honest government that I have seen in talking to its people. They all save like crazy, save money, they buy gold, and they are told to store food. It's not happening here except on the road show, the road trips that Secretary Leavitt's taking. He's telling people to store food. Unfortunately, he made the statement one time, put some skim milk powder and some milk powder and tuna and fish under your beds. Well, you know, everybody liked to get a big laugh out of that. His religious background is, I believe, Latter-day Saints, Mormon community, where they saved food all the time, a year's worth. A very wise idea. Folks who have no room in their homes are often told, and I've told my clients as well, put food underneath your bed if you don't have much food. It's wasted space under there. The shoes don't have to go under there. Stick food underneath your bed. But you really should also plan for growing some things, being able to grow some things, or teaming up with somebody who has a backyard who can grow some things, and plan to get the non-hybrid seeds that you can save yourself to grow from year to year, because all it will take is one season interruption and we are in very deep trouble. And our country, because we're so industrialized and dependent on everybody else, our country will be in as bad shape, if not worse shape, than a third world country used to scratching out the ground and planting their beans and corn every year.
At least they're, of course, used to look after themselves and providing the food, and they're not dependent upon the local grocery store, the local supermarket to get their food. Well, we've got David calling, and let's see where David's calling from. David's calling from Corona. So, David, hi, did you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yeah, I'm just wondering how big of a spot, like, say, in our backyard? I was looking at your website, too.
Speak up just a little louder, David.
Yeah, I was looking at the website and mentioned the hybrid seeds. How big of an area in our yard
okay.
do we...
There's enough, there are enough seeds in the package to provide for a large garden, but you don't need that large a garden. If you were to have a place, say, 10 feet by 20 feet, or even 5 feet by 20 feet, that's 100 square feet. If you have that big a space, you can, by intensively planting, you can plant a whole lot of food, at least all of the food that you could eat fresh in a year. If you double to that larger size, then you would have enough food to eat fresh plus can to save. Let's face it, David, you can grow one tomato plant well, and if you grow it well, you can get over 100 pounds of tomatoes out of some of these old varieties. They're fantastically productive. So, and green beans, for example, the green beans that we put in the package, they are very, very productive and high in protein, so on. Zucchini, my gosh, they reproduce better than rabbits, and they're very high in protein as well. So, yeah, you can do it, and you can do it in landscaping around your home, and put in zucchini plants here and there, and put in pepper plants. I would sit down with a good book, and we have books up there. Take a look at them. Sit down with a book and decide you're going to read this coming fall and winter and decide how you're going to plant things next year. There's actually time to put in fall crops this year, things like broccoli, cabbage. You can put those things in. You can start planting those in flats in July to put outdoors in the fall in moderate temperature areas of the country. And you're from Corona, California, are you?
Corona, California.
Okay, well, certainly you have a long growing cycle, and you should be able to grow things like peas in your fall. As a matter of fact, even on the East Coast and parts of the West, you can grow peas in the fall, and you'll find peas in this package. These are the kinds of things you should be thinking about because, in fact, no political group running for office right now is going to tell you if they know, if they've looked at their own U.S. Department of Agriculture's figures. They're not going to tell you what the bottom line is, that, oh gosh, yes, we can go hungry here. My own personal feeling is there are very few of them who have looked at that big picture. One exception would be, and he's not in the government, he works for the government sometimes, would be Dr. Michael Osterholm out of SIDREP. Now, he also works for Department of Homeland Defense. He is an epidemiologist, and he is concerned with bioterrorism. There's a whole big new bioterrorism building going up in Virginia right now that is going to handle this. We are very concerned as a government that bird flu and some similar pandemic organism will be used as a bioterrorist weapon. And so right now, maybe that's Maryland, that's not Virginia, that's going up. But at any rate, he is an exception in that he has plainly said out in public, and it's also on the SIDREP website in Foreign Affairs Magazine, he has plainly said, where is the food going to come from? How can we ensure our people will be able to eat? And our government has said it's going to be faith-based organizations that are going to be helping to deliver food. Well, it's hardly a solution when you don't have masks and gowns for people, when you don't have truckers to deliver the food to your community, when you don't have water because people aren't showing up to work because they're so ill or people at home are dying. They have to take care of them.
And the other thing is, of course, where are the faith-based organizations going to get the food?
That's correct.
And David, basically, Jerry's, her food, her seeds are not hybrid seeds. They're they're heirloom seeds, and they're actually passed down from generation to generation. And certainly, if she'll tell you how to actually prepare the ground, the fertilizer, all those things are covered in her website. And have you been up on the website?
Yeah, we're just on it right now, as you guys mentioned.
And of course, Jerry, did you get your telephone number out?
Yes, 1-800-255-1912. 1-800-255-1912. And, we would recommend Seed Sowing and Saving, which is a book, a very simple book, easy to read, on doing exactly that. How to sow seed and how to save seed from year to year from your own crops.
Well, I think that's really survival important. Anything else you want to ask, David?
Oh, okay. I guess for you, Dr. Stan, I noticed on the Ark Institute there's big Berkeys on there too, but only in California is it the big Berkey, right?
No, you can get the Berkey Light in California.
Oh,
you can't get
light,
the big Berkey in California.
Right,
and if you don't have a Berkey Light, you really need to have one. They're just great to have on hand. And I think the big Berkey is great, but you can't get him for you in California. So we're not gonna try to fight with Arnold. He's in better shape than I am.
Yeah. Okay. You got that on your website, right?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
And you can get it from either Jerry or from us. Anyway, God bless.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much. And let's go to before we go to Bob from Tennessee, who's calling right now. A caller called and wanted to know how global warming would affect the growing of crops.
All right. How global warming will affect? for every 1 degree Celsius change, increase in the temperature of the earth, world grain crops, and most agricultural specialists now agree, will go down 10% in production. We are seeing that increase in temperature. We are seeing the decrease in productivity. We're seeing the grain drop in productivity around the world.
Is that because the temperature? Is that because, of course, the change in the soil, the fact that...
Everything, but we know now that global warming, or at least, and I don't want to get into arguments with people on the air, say global warming, it's like triggering some people who get very upset over that. Whatever the cause, natural cycle or man's activities on the planet, I happen to believe the latter, but whatever the cause, it is happening. And grain production is dropping.
All right, but the two going together. In other words,
yes,
certainly we'll be opening a lot more land up in Canada and the northern parts there, because now, of course, they would have a growing cycle.
But water,
before.
But water is much more important. The water tables are dropping.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, fine. Well, let's go then to Bob, who's calling us from Tennessee. Bob, are you there?
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. How are you tonight?
I'm fine.
Do you have a question for Jerry?
Well, first, I'd like to endorse several products you mentioned. I had bought some seeds from her before, and I do have a Berkey filter. I've been real pleased with both of them.
All right, fine. Well, I appreciate the words of encouragement and endorsement. Anyway, did you have a question for Jerry?
Yeah, one of the things she was talking about earlier, you know, during the Depression, I paid a lot of attention to my grandparents. They grew up during that era. At that time, you know, we had small family-owned farms,
right,
all across this country, and people could afford to live on a small family farm and make a living.
Right.
We can't do that anymore.
No.
That's one of the things today. I live a lifestyle, I guess, out of tradition. I live on a small farm. I don't do it for a living. I work another job. But we do have a small farm. We grow most of what we eat. It's not, it's out of tradition. It's out of just, and what we get out of it is exercise, relaxation, and a healthy food. And you can do that. You don't have to have a farm. You can do it in just a small plot in the backyard.
Absolutely.
Like, you get so much out of it. You get the exercise out of it. You're outside. You get the relaxation.
Vitamin D from the sun.
you get so much out of it. Plus, you get some good, healthy food.
Absolutely.
There's so many things that, you know, if you look at it as work, well, yeah, it is hard work, and it's really not worth the money. If you want to go to your local grocery store and just pick it up, but you're not getting all those benefits.
I think with Bob right now, I think your experience and your knowledge are very, very important, because I can't say absolutely, but I've got a terrible feeling that life as we know it is going to change, and change dramatically in the not-too-distant future.
Right.
I can foresee a nuclear war. I can see the spread of pestilence in our society. I can see increasing social unrest in our society as we move from being an American culture to a multicultural, multilingual society. And I think all these things are planned, and I'm not going to be able to change it. All I can do is make suggestions to people and, you know, to begin to prepare for these things. And you know a lot more about growing things than I do. I'm trying to learn because I want to be able to look after myself and my family in what I think are going to be very difficult times that lie ahead.
Well, I'm a lot more optimistic than I probably was a few years ago, Dr. Stan. I believe that you know, they gave me just enough of the American dream to keep me hooked and keep me going on and not really complaining to the point where we should have really done something. But I think this new generation coming up, and I'm working with a lot of young people right now in an apprenticeship program where I'm helping to train them. They're where I was at 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and they've got families, and they're looking around, and they can't afford the American dream.
Right.
They're working as hard as I was, but they're realizing they can't afford it.
And the only way they're going to get it is, of course, we can cut back on the size of government and cut back, you know, on their control of our lives. The only way, of course, to preserve the American dream is, of course, to get back to what our founding fathers did. They had tariffs to protect our industries and to begin concerned about America rather than bringing democracy to the whole world. Let's preserve America, and secondarily, why, if we can maintain our freedom, then maybe we can help other people to establish theirs. But in the process of trying to help everybody else in the world, we're giving up our freedom here, and our boys go overseas to fight for freedom in Afghanistan and Iraq. And we find the government's tracking all of our financial things. They're listening to our telephone calls. And all this talk about, oh, my goodness, isn't it terrible what they're doing, tracking the terrorists? They're not tracking the terrorists. They're tracking every citizen in the United States. Every citizen in the United States. That's what it's really all about. So they talk about the wrong things, and if we allow them to create our reality, and we listen to what they're saying, we're not going to understand what's really going on. We're moving into a dictatorship, and those kids aren't going to have the American dream unless you and I can get the information out about the plan for the New World Order and the New World Religion. Hey, Bob, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you. Shows like yours are real important, and I've been turning a lot of these young fellas on to your show, and a lot of them's listening to
God bless
yours and some of these other shows. And your shows like this are real important. They tried in the public schools to dumb these kids down, but they didn't do a real good job on some of them.
Well, I'm glad they're at least in Tennessee that some of them still got some good common sense. Hey,
thanks
a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Bob, Jerry, you got about 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, I guess we've just about said it all, and I guess the best thing to say is this isn't hype. This is fact. I know it's tough to wrap your mind around, but we're standing on the edge of a precipice. I'm really hoping and praying that this bird flu is going to end up burning itself out, dying out after it infects a bunch of people and a bunch of birds. It's going to mutate to a dead end. That would be a blessing. That would be merciful. Right now, it's looking like it's developing like 1918 was developing. And the results at current fatality rates are even lower, are going to be nothing short of catastrophic. So if people will prepare their families now, do without things that might be excess in your lives, and prepare your families now by putting away food, water, and so on. Even if you put away water in pop bottles, put some away. If you can take care of yourself, the catastrophes won't be as big as they might be if you don't have anything to take care of yourself, because there isn't going to be cavalry coming to the rescue. You'll starve to death before you wait for, as the government plans, faith-based organizations to come around and save you in your own home. How many can you name off one hand that exist in your community that are going to feed you, that have the food to feed you and the water to feed you, get you your medicines and so on that you need?
I remember, Chris, that when New Orleans, it was FEMA that was actually keeping the supplies out. They were keeping the water out. They were keeping the food out. They were keeping the rescuers out. They were keeping the boats, and the hydroplanes and all the things that, things that people could have done to have rescued the people there in New Orleans. Why would the government do something that stupid unintentionally? They were even going around cutting the communications wires over in Jefferson Parish, to the point where the sheriff over there, Tommy Jones, gave orders to shoot anybody from FEMA who came in there and tried to disrupt that. You do not look to the government to help you.
Now, the government's own website says to expect civil disorder.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, begin to make preparations for the unthinkable. Could it happen? I believe it could, and I believe it's our obligation to sound the warning, and certainly that's what Jerry Guidetti is doing. Our guest this evening has been Jerry Guidetti from the ARC Institute. One more time, the telephone number?
1-800-255-1912, arcinstitute.com.
God bless you. Good night, Jerry.
God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there listening to us, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family, because that's how we're able to do what we do. And you join the family, you get our regular monthly newsletter, you get, of course, our tapes of the month, but more than that, you're helping us get the information out. And then, of course, we do carry the Berkey products, and we do carry our Miracle 2 soap products. We carry the Robinson Homeschool. We're carrying health products, and we've got all sorts of great things. In fact, if you're not taking magnesium and you don't have good supplies of vitamin C and vitamin D an alibiotic, which is a combination of oil of oregano and elderberry juice and garlic and three or four other things that are sort of natural antibiotics. It's called alibiotic. We carry these things. If you'd like a free health catalog, we'll be glad to send it to you. And of course, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to getting your health products from us, because, well, basically, we are getting them from the, I think, the most outstanding producer of health products in the nation. But, of course, we cannot market under their label. So you're going to be getting RL products. You'll never guess what RL stands for, but anyway, they're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. Let me suggest, if you have not yet read the book, The Miracle of Magnesium, you get it, and you realize we're all deficient in magnesium. And it's a really amazing a change in people's attitude and sleeping patterns and just general health when you get the magnesium levels up. And if you'd like to get, of course, Carolyn Dean's book, The Miracle of Magnesium, we do carry it. We think it's important. And we have information on so many other things in the health field and the things that you need to know about it. Did you know that they're poisoning us with mercury in so many of the vaccines and the influenza vaccine? If you take the influenza vaccine, you're between 60 and 65. You take three or four shots over a five-year period, your incidence of Alzheimer's goes up 1,000%. The government knows that. In fact, the doctor who put that out, Dr. Fudenberg, he's been attacked and demonized. Why? Because they don't want you to know that. If you'd like to get the abstract from his webpage and you can't find it, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. You need to get Dr. Blaylock's wonderful book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. You've got to understand they're poisoning us with NutraSweet and MSG and soy products. They're poisoning us with the fluoride in the water. They know what it's doing, how it attacks fertility and intelligence, and that's why Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler fluoridated the water in the occupied zones during the Second World War, but not in Germany. That's why the Soviets actually fluoridated the water in Eastern Europe. They fluoridated the water in the Gulag, but not in Russia itself. Why? Because, of course, it's used to dull the senses, and they wanted a complacent people. In fact, it said that actually after they stopped fluoridating water in East Berlin and Eastern Europe, why the dental care got ever so much better. Why? Because the fluoride was actually making the dental incidence of dental cavities worse. But you're never going to hear that from public health officials here in the United States. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival, because this is a spiritual battle. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.